Welcome. Good to have you all with us. I want to remind you as we jump into this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are waiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's transplant program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. And welcome, everybody. We're going to spend the next hour and a half wrestling with the issue of guns in America. I think sometimes it's important to take a look back in our history, to think about where all this came from and what the issues are around gun ownership, not just gun ownership, but the right to own and bear arms. And we are joined here by Dr. Carol Emberton, who's assistant professor of history at the University of Buffalo. She wrote the book Beyond Redemption, Race, Violence, and the American South After the Civil War, which has perked my interest about her thinking, and she joins us here. And are the guests available yet? Not yet. Okay. So, Carol, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You know, we say, I've said often here on the program and other places, that whenever you look at issues that face this country, the issue of race is never far behind or never far away from most major issues that we face. The same with the whole notion of right to bear arms. But let me ask you first to take us to where you the book that you wrote about Reconstruction and the Second and 15th Amendments, and describe those and how they intersected in that piece of history you may not know about the beginnings of this kind of almost fanaticism to for the right to bear arms.
Right. Well, my book really explores the political culture and the role that violence played in the political culture of emancipation, sort of in the wake of the Civil War and slave emancipation in 1865, which, of course, freed some 4.5 million slaves in the former Confederacy, and the attempts by their allies in Congress as well as themselves to become full participating citizens in this nation and to enjoy certain rights of citizenship. And one of the really interesting things I found in those congressional debates in the 1860s is that radical Republicans in Congress and their attempts to get civil rights legislation passed on the behalf of freed slaves, as well as the efforts of black veterans and freed people in the South themselves, is that they linked and began to link the right to vote with the right to bear arms. Black veterans argued that black men deserve the right to vote after the Civil War because they had served in the nation's military, they had served in the Union Army, and they had performed, you know, that such an important civic obligation that they had earned the right to vote. And they looked at the efforts that former Confederates were making in the South to actively disarm freed people. And they said that, you know, the only way that we're going to be able to live peacefully and to enjoy the rights of citizenship in the South is to possess arms, not only to be involved in collectively in militias and law enforcement and those kinds of collective organizations where we bear arms, but also to possess arms individually. In order to exercise this new right to vote, which they gained in 1870, they believe, they argue, we're also going to have, you know, a reinvigorated understanding of the Second Amendment as a fundamental part of individual American citizenship.
One of the things that I find fascinating about this period this whole era, and I know that it's, you didn't write the book about this, so I might want to wander back a bit to the Revolutionary War as well, but
sure.
And the origins of the Second Amendment, but that the radical Republicans, the folks in Congress who wanted to kind of push Reconstruction, and also the black and white allies in the South after the Civil War, who wanted to build this kind of new multiracial democracy. I mean, they did tie, as you were saying, they tied the Second Amendment to the 15th Amendment. And the interesting interpretation was that the right to bear arms was very clear from the radical Republican perspective. They were saying that folks have a right, black people in particular, have a right to bear arms to defend themselves and their homes and land.
Yeah, and for them, it was really a practical concern. I mean, the Republican Party is looking to secure its national ascendancy. They want African Americans in the South to have the right to vote because they predict, and rightly so, that they're going to vote for the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation. And in order to do that, they have to be able to get to the polls safely and to battle the intense, organized intimidation and violent tactics that organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist paramilitaries are organizing against those grassroots efforts at political mobilization in the South. So it's a practical issue for them. The law enforcement mechanisms in the post-war South, in rural areas, particularly outside of the major urban areas of the 19th century South, are practically non-existent. There are no state police forces. The soldiers, the Union soldiers that were in the South at the immediate aftermath of the war have been pulled out. They've been sent west to battle Indians for the most part, and there's no kind of institutional structure at work to actively protect black voters, and so they're going to have to do it themselves.
And this whole idea of militias, I mean, when you look at, I've been reading a great deal about the arguments around the Second Amendment during the build-up of the U.S. Constitution. And it was very clear that not all, but a lot of the arguments came from the South. A lot of them came from the Southern militias to ensure that after the Revolutionary War, that slaves could be held in control. And in a place like South Carolina and Georgia, every able-bodied man had to be in a militia to do this.
Exactly. The slave patrols in the antebellum in the early republic, the slave patrols doubled as militias, right? And so this is why the delegates to the Constitutional Convention are so adamant that they want some kind of guarantee written into this Constitution in order for them to give it their support. They want some kind of guarantee that abolitionists in the northern states, places like New Hampshire, where emancipation has already been written into the state constitution, or in New York, where gradual emancipation have been written into their state constitutions, are not going to basically try to abolish slavery in the South through the back door by having Congress call away, right, the individual state militias and send them, you know, to fight Indians in the Vermont backwoods or to repel an invasion, you know, of the British in Canada or whatever it might be, right? They want to maintain that security of that system at home in the plantation South, and in order to do that, they demand that some kind of guarantee be placed in the Constitution that Congress will not interfere with their militias stroke slave patrols.
So I'm going to ask you a question about this kind of direct linkage from our history to the present in a moment and how you see it. But let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Dr. Carol Emberton is our guest. She's assistant professor of history at the University of Buffalo. The book she wrote is Beyond Redemption, Race, Violence in the American South After the Civil War. And we will also be linking to her article that she wrote. And that'll be on our website at steinershow.org and link to our other work as well. Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Lester, you're on the air, and this is Dr. Lester Spence, I believe, frequent guest on the show, professor of political science from Hopkins. Lester.
Hey, what's up, man? How are you doing?
Good, well. Welcome, man.
I'm calling from Detroit, from my parents' home, and literally as I'm calling, the TV news is saying that there's been a kid that was shot at one of Detroit's high schools. My cousin was one of the first deaths in what became the Blood Crip gang violence of the 80s. I've had another cousin lose his life to handgun violence like a few years ago, and then one of my best friends died like a week after 9/11 defending his home, also from handgun violence. I think that the tying racism and the relationship between racism and the right to bear arms is complicated. So you go back to the 60s when the Black Panthers go to the seat of California state government bearing arms. Ronald Reagan immediately wants to curtail, immediately engage in gun control acts. Martin Luther King Jr. had an armed weapon, a number of them, in his home. because he knew that the police, just like the sister said, that the police could not and would not defend them from white racists. And like I said, you hear people in the background. My parents here. But it's really, really complicated. But the bottom line is that we have to somehow wrestle with handgun violence, and we have to do so on the side of more gun control than less.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say this is probably great for our next segment as well. That when we hit this at the half hour for an hour, when we're going to wrestle with the policies now and how they relate to race in the past. So, if you want to hang on for that, that'd be great, because you always have good things to say.
Yeah, and the other thing is that I think I have a vehicle to the extent that what we're looking at is a fight, not so much for the hearts and minds of citizens, but for a fight to give political representatives who are on our side, quote unquote, ammunition, and to give people who may be on the fence more reason to support us. I think I've got something that I'll talk about at a later time that can really, really, that everybody can participate in, that I think could have really, really strong results. So I just wanted to give you a shout out. I just came up with the idea today. I love the work you guys do, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, take care, Lester. Thank you. We're also joined now by Paul Barrett, Assistant Managing Editor and Senior Writer of Bloomberg Businessweek and author of Glock, The Rise of the American Gun, which was a New York Times bestseller. And Paul Barrett, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So one of the things that we'll take a step back, I want to come back and talk to Carol about how this history ties to our present. The book you wrote was really fascinating. In some ways, it was almost as a microcosm about the gun industry. And I think that's part of what we see in America. Carol Emerton, another guest at this moment, wrote about that in her piece, just about the power of the Colt industry in the 1850s and how it exploded across America in the 1860s and just been exponentially exploding ever since. And
yes, I think the comparison is a very, very good one. I think Gaston Glock, the founder of the Glock companies, is very much the Samuel Colt of the late 20th century, and both men made fortunes based on this very unusual fascination that American culture has with firearms.
So tell me I'm curious what you think. I mean, both of you now, starting with Paul and go to Carol. I mean, how does that play itself out? I mean, this has to do with both the roots, as Carol wrote about it, we'll talk about in a moment, of the power of the gun industry that began in the 1850s and 60s and where it is right now.
Well, one way it is playing itself out is that Glock's history and its commercial success was dependent in significant part on opposition to Glock, efforts to restrict the company. And one of the phenomena that has been important since the 1980s has been the counterintuitive effects that efforts to regulate gun ownership have had. If you try to ban the Glock, as gun control proponents did in the late 1980s, you actually turn it into a poster child in the eyes of gun owners and the NRA, and that benefits the company. We've seen the same phenomenon with the so-called assault rifle or military-style semi-automatic rifle. Efforts to demonize the weapon, to say that this is the source of our social problems, has the opposite effect from what its opponents wish to have.
Carol, talk about from a historical perspective how that played out around Colt.
Well, the Colt story is really interesting because, of course, in the 20th century, the Colt firearms manufacturing becomes eclipsed by the very kind of things that Paul is talking about, the Glocks and these more modern weapons. But in the 19th century, particularly sort of in the Reconstruction era, of course, Colts they have this kind of cultural cachet that the Glocks have today, right? In 1873, the Colt company, Samuel Colt, dies in 1864, but the company goes on. In 1873, the Colt company, of course, manufactures its legendary peacemaker revolver, right? The gun that won the West. And that is when this idea, you know, that Abe Lincoln freed man, but Samuel Colt made them equal.
Right.
The idea that this particular gun, the Colt, the peacemaker in particular, had become the equalizer, right, for Americans, you know, sort of as their, you know, the legend goes, taming the frontier, conquering the Indians, you know, spreading sort of American nationalism, you know, throughout the West. And so the Colt's gun really becomes emblematic, right, of that post-Civil War, sort of late 19th century, sort of, you know, the gunfighter nation that Richard Slotkin talks about in his work.
Yeah, I think everything that Carol's saying is 100% correct and really profoundly important. And it's because it's so important because if you do not appreciate how symbolically significant firearms are to Americans and the degree to which they are woven into American culture, for better or for worse, if you don't appreciate that, accept that, then you really will misunderstand any given debate of the moment. You won't understand why people react to a particular legislative proposal one way or the other. If you just assume that guns are just another article of commerce, like a toaster or a dishwasher, you're going to miss the boat. And the history, the deep history that Carol's describing helps illuminate that. This is not something that has just sprung up in recent times. The American fascination with firearms has been there since the very founding of the Republic, when one of the very first images of an American was the Minuteman with a musket.
Well, I mean, we have to remember that we're going back to the Revolution, though. The laws were what they said was very clear, that if you were fought in the Revolution or for the Revolution, you had to own a gun. And you had to bring it to militia meetings. You had to own a gun. And most communities knew which gun you had. If you were against the Revolution or fought with the Brits, you were not allowed to have a gun. And black folks definitely were not allowed to have guns in the late 1700s, early 1800s.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in the past, we've had forms of gun regulation that today, of course, would strike us as outrageous in the ways that gun regulation has been used as a tool of racism is probably the leading example of that.
And as the, you know, it reminded me of this too, listening to the caller who teaches political science at Hopkins. I missed his name, but
Lester Spence.
Yeah, the irony is, right, that the symbolic importance, particularly for African Americans, of being able to own guns, you know, it does go back to the American Revolution. They were denied the right to bear arms. They were written out in the 1790s of the federal sort of militia legislation, right? They were expressly barred from participating in the armed forces, of serving in militias, and various, you know, in the black codes in the South after the Civil War, you know, prohibited them from owning firearms. So it has a particular kind of symbolic importance as well, and this is what the radical Republicans during Reconstruction were really hitting on by linking the Second Amendment and the 15th Amendment. But what happens is that they then had to deal with a public safety crisis of their own making, in large part, because freed people were the ones who were most often becoming the victims of gun violence in the Reconstruction South. You know, there were countless, you know, some large, some smaller, you know, race riots, voting riots, election day riots throughout the South during the 1860s and 1870s. And more often than not, you know, African Americans are outgunned because, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, a variety of reasons, they don't have access or, you know, they've been disarmed by these vigilante groups. So even as American citizenship becomes tied, you know, more and more closely to gun ownership, it's more often than not black people who are vulnerable and who become victims of the violence that kind of political culture, you know, gives rise to.
And if you fast forward to the 1960s, from the 1860s and 70s, and the Black Panther Party walks into the state capitol in Sacramento, armed, saying we have, because of the California laws at that point, we have the right to bear arms and to defend ourselves against the police and anybody else. Then you have the then Republican Party under Ronald Reagan as governor saying we have to have gun control, and the only reason you should have guns is to hunt, and only policemen should have guns. And all these guns were passed under Republican administration in the early 70s to limit gun buying in California. It's also the same period when there was revolt in the NRA. I mean, when I was a Boy Scout, I was in the NRA because I had passed my marksmanship merit badge. Nobody who got a marksmanship merit badge was in the NRA, whether you wanted to be or not. And so the NRA in the early 70s was then taken over by the group that controls it now, which wanted to change gun control laws so they could have guns. And so once again, I mean, this is that isn't it, it sounds convoluted, but it's not. I mean, this is our history is really intertwined in all of this with America, race, gun rights. I don't think, Carol, you can extricate the two.
No, it's very, very difficult, and I, you know, I'm often asked. I mean, people want to know. They want a definitive answer, right? Does the Constitution guarantee an individual right, you know, an unfettered, unregulated access to bear arms, or is it simply meant, you know, for a collective, you know, state-controlled militias? And I think it's impossible to answer that question. Both sides of this issue, both sides of the gun debate, you know, sort of are able to read the to read the vague wording of the Constitution in this very complicated history, and they're able to pick pieces out of it, you know, to fit whatever story they want to tell. But when you really sit down and you try to piece together this evidence, it's a really complicated things to try to sort of parse out.
Paul?
Can't disagree with anything she just said. I think, though, we do know one answer, which is that the Supreme Court has said pretty clearly that a total ban on handguns is not going to wash. That's not consistent with the Second Amendment. And for the moment, anyway, until the personnel in the Supreme Court changes, if that happens, that's what the Second Amendment means.
And not saying, you know, there's a huge argument whether or not you should ban handguns, that notwithstanding, I think one of the things that because a lot
press
of people have handguns.
For that, help, press zero.
Hello. I'm sorry, that was somebody. Everybody still there, Carol and Paul?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Play your current.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I have no idea what happened there. I think we need a telephone man to fix our phones. But when you look at where we are now, and I was thinking about what both of you have written about, again, the kind of power of the gun industry, and that's part of the untold story here. I mean, I think that, you know, we can limit clips and we can say, no, you shouldn't buy this weapon, and we have to register this weapon, and there should be background checks on people before they buy weapons, so the mentally ill can get weapons and violent felons can't get weapons. All that's fine in the debate about what to do. But the real issue, I think, that we don't want to wrestle with is kind of the lack of regulation on and the real power of what in this country is a $1 billion gun industry and what internationally is almost a $3 trillion gun industry, much of it coming out of America and Western Europe. And I think that is the issue of the last 110, 120 years, whatever this number has been, that no one's confronting.
Well, I would dissent slightly from what you said.
Please do. Go ahead.
The gun industry has influence because there are gun buyers, and the NRA has influence because a majority of Americans view the NRA favorably. The most recent Gallup polling on this, which took place, by the way, after the Newtown massacre, showed that 54% of Americans view the NRA generally favorably. So that's not a fringe group that's manipulating our politics. That's a group that has a significant base of support. That same Gallup poll, again, after the Newtown massacre, showed that more than 80% of Republicans have a favorable view of the NRA. So if you're a Republican politician, it's not for some strange reason that you enforce the NRA's agenda. It's because you want to get reelected. This is, in a lot of ways, democracy in action. It may not please everybody. In fact, obviously, it doesn't please everybody. But it, in some ways, is not as mysterious or nefarious as it's sometimes portrayed. It's called elective politics.
Carol, you want to leap in on this a little bit before we take a break?
Well, you know, this is one of the larger parts I make in my book that, you know, sort of, you know, whether we like it or not, this is in some sense the essence of American democracy, right? It has this very violent strain that runs through it, not only in terms of the kinds of discourse and rhetoric that people use to describe what citizenship means and how it should be obtained and maintained, but also in practice as well.
So we have to take a brief break here, and we're going to go into a discussion about the gun regulations being proposed in New York for our listeners there and what's happening here in Maryland and what President Barack Obama said today. But I'd like to just take a brief break and bring you all back for just 5 more minutes or so just to complete this part of the discussion. Would you mind staying on for a minute?
Sure, no problem.
Happy to.
All right, we'll be right back. Don't go away, folks. We continue our discussion about guns in America, and we'll have all of our politicians, advocates, and dissenters on in a few minutes as well. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're going to continue our conversation with our two guests here from the last half hour, Dr. Carol Emberton, assistant professor of history at the University of Buffalo and author of the book Beyond Redemption, Race, Violence, and the American South After the Civil War, and Paul Barrett, an assistant managing editor and senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, author of the best-selling book Glock, The Rise of the American Gun. 410-319-8888 is the number here, let's continue this part of our conversation as we get our other guests lined up on the phone to join us here for the discussion about what to do now in terms of the law. So, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, Paul, you just said, and it is this conflicting piece of American history, and I think we'll start with you and go to Carol on this. I mean, as you were describing those polls, I was looking at the polls during the break here, and the polls, as you said, are correct. However, there are also other polls like in Pew that show the contradictions people feel, because the majority of people feel like there could be a ban on high-capacity ammunition clips or background checks should be much more intense and detailed. I mean, both those things are true.
Well, as with many issues, you end up with cross-cutting attitudes. And if you ask people very specific questions, you might get different answers than if you ask a very broad question. What strikes me about the Gallup numbers is not that they tell you anything about a particular gun control proposal or any particular public policy, but simply that a majority of Americans do not view the NRA as an organization as being at the fringe of American politics. They may disagree with it, but they see it as something that they have respect for it. And that is a reality that I think many people who are politically liberal have trouble accepting.
Mm-hmm. Carol?
I agree with what Paul is saying, is that the symbolic power, right, of guns is so sort of ingrained in our culture that if you ask people sort of generally about gun ownership or about the NRA, they're going to respond in a generally sort of favorable way, and it's not really a sort of a fringe issue, although there are certainly people, within the NRA or within the guns rights sort of movement that seem to have, and articulate, extremely, very extreme sort of views that, as Paul said, are hard for people on the left, liberal people who support gun restrictions to get their head around.
I mean, part of it is in a way, before we take another break and bring our other guests on, is that when you look at American history, and the right to own guns and who had guns, it very much had to do, as you wrote about, Carol, about the militias of the past, who kept slaves down, who wanted to ensure the federal government could not come in and tell them what to do. I think it was your book when you wrote about the piece about when the after Reconstruction was destroyed, that militia in South Carolina ended up in Boston to celebrate the centennial?
Right. Right. And so, what I really talk about is that, you know, in some ways, our modern gun rights debate owes a lot more to 1876, the end of Reconstruction, than it does 1776, the American Revolution. Although you'll hear, you know, the gun rights, you know, advocates talk about 1776, and they'll invoke the American Revolution a lot. You know, I actually think that that is a way to sort of, you know, lend legitimacy, right, to a movement that I think has much more recent roots. Paul's right, you know, and other scholars, you know, Adam Winkler, who have written about the 1960s and 70s and what you were talking about with the Black Panthers and the Republican response to that out in California, but also sort of 1876 and this end of Reconstruction where these white vigilante groups, which for the better part of a decade had been sort of wreaking havoc for freed people throughout the South, killing, murdering, you know, driving people from the polls and effectively in a lot of places throughout the Deep South, sort of breaking Black political organization and sort of turning the tides of radical Reconstruction sort of back the other way. By 1876, which of course, ironically, was also the year of America's centennial celebrations. And in 1875, the summer before, you have a celebration in Boston celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Bunker Hill. And those some of those same militia units from South Carolina that were the remnants or the, you know, the progeny of revolutionary militia units from Charleston were invited up to Boston to participate in these Bunker Hill ceremonies and, you know, and were hailed as, you know, sort of the reincarnation, right, of the founding generation and as symbols of the country's or at least the white American sort of reunification, you know, after the Civil War. So there's a general sort of, there's a romanticism, there's a warm sort of glowy feeling around this era, and in some ways that kind of reunification is brought about through guns, right, and through this idea that there's this founding moment, that there's this revolutionary tradition that white people share, right, that white people share and protect themselves against Black people with guns.
We're going to take a break. And, Paul, unless you want to have a thought in there, then we're going to break and bring our other guests in.
No, that, I think that's a very profound observation, and I would just leave it right there.
Paul Barrett, you just heard, assistant managing editor and senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, wrote the book, the best-selling book, Glock, The Rise of the American Gun. Dr. Carol Emberton is assistant professor of history at the University of Buffalo and author of Beyond Redemption, Race, Violence, and the American South After the Civil War. If you go to steinershow.org after the show, we'll be linking to all their works, both of our guest works, and you can read more about what they're writing and thinking about. And Paul Barrett and Carol Emberton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.